This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. The most memorable interviews and listener calls from the week that was on Fight Back with Libby Znaimer. Welcome to the best of Fight Back with Jane Brown.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Sunday edition of the Best of Fight Back. More of what you want to hear from the week that was. The We Charity controversy heated up this past week with testimony in front of the Commons Finance Committee by the We co-founders, Craig and Mark Kielberger, and then later in the week by Prime Minister Justin Trudeau himself. Both the Prime Minister and his Finance Minister, Bill Morneau, are being investigated by the Ethics Commissioner for possible conflict of interest violations related to their family connections to We Charity. Prior to Trudeau's testimony, Fight Back devoted Wednesday's show to the testimony by the Kielberger brothers. Did they put the scandal over that $500 million contract to rest or spark further questions? Did they clarify the Prime Minister's role in it? Was this a cozy quid pro quo deal, or as they insisted, a case of we just trying to help the government out in a crisis? And what of the questions about their own charity and its relationship with their for-profit entities? Joining Libby Znaimer to answer these questions, Michael Cooper, Conservative Deputy Finance Critic, strategist Robin Sears, Principal of Earnscliffe Strategy Group, NDP strategist Kim Wright, Principal of Wright Strategies, Conservative strategist and president with Enterprise, Jason Leader, and Conservative Finance Critic, Pierre Poliev.
We got some explosive revelations. First of all, we learned that the Trudeau family has received hundreds of thousands of dollars of additional expenses reimbursements from the Kielberger network, more money than we originally knew. And of course, we already knew that the Trudeau family had been paid over $300,000 in speaking fees. Now we know that accommodations, transportation, and other expense reimbursements add up to in the neighborhood of $100,000. So one reporter calculated that we're now around almost $500,000 that the Kielbergers and the We organizations have paid the Trudeau family. We also learned that Margaret Trudeau only began getting paid for speaking after her son became prime minister. So you'd think that if she had some expertise to justify all the speaking fees, she would have been paid for that expertise before he took office. But curiously, those payments only began after he took office. So you really have to wonder whether or not they were paying for her speeches or if they were paying for political power.
They kept insisting that with that proposed deal, they wouldn't make a cent of profit. It was just expenses. Is that believable?
Yes, and it's irrelevant. You don't have to make a profit to make money. It's weasel words. We know all kinds of people who own numbered companies that don't run profits, but the owners are multi-millionaires. Why? Because they pay expenses through the organization to themselves. And as I proved in the committee yesterday, there's nothing in the contribution agreement to prevent the Kielberger brothers from paying themselves and declaring that those payments to be expenses under the contribution agreement. In fact, one section of the agreement says that they can pay salaries and wages without even keeping timesheets to show hours worked. So it's absolutely accurate that they wouldn't that the We Charity wouldn't make a profit. It's supposedly a charity. It's not ever supposed to make a profit. But that doesn't mean the people who control the charity can't themselves make money. And that's the issue at stake here.
Anything else on consequences that you're looking for? Resignations?
Well, Bill Morneau has to resign. He broke the Ethics Act again, and he did so flagrantly. I don't know what to say other than that. You know, the guy personally intervenes to help get a $500 million contribution to a group that took him on a $41,000 illegal vacation. I don't know what if you that doesn't trigger resignation. I don't know what does.
Let's bring in a pair of experienced strategists, Jason Leader, a conservative strategist and president of Enterprise, and Kim Wright, principal of Wright Strategies. Let's start with Kim. How did the Kielbergers do?
Wow. On about six different levels, they could have won, check themselves out a bit before they went on screen and maybe not use the phrase if even a bit of these things are that people are saying about us is untrue, we would, you know, be pale in the face. Well, they looked pretty pale, and they looked it was not the best video quality, and they, you don't want to come across slick on these things, but the problem was that anyone looking at those screens, either they came across a bit smug, and they came across as a bit dodgy. Yes, 4 hours is a long time to be grilled by parliamentarians. I felt that they were, in some cases, and yes, many of the members of parliament were very pointed and very aggressive at times with them. But the response from the Kielbergers should not have been nearly as smug and dismissive. These are parliamentarians trying to get to the bottom of things, and they were acting as if they were called to the principal's offices. There are consequences to these things, and significant ones for their business.
Jason.
Well, Kim, you let off pretty strongly there, and I'm even going to pile on a little bit more. I thought they were brutal. For a lot of different reasons, both in tone and substance. So I think Kim's nailed the tone side of this, which is, especially the first 2 hours of this thing, it was like they were in model parliament in the UN in high school. They were laughing, they were giggling, they weren't taking it that serious. It was a fundamental unseriousness to it, which I think was a real problem. And then when they got combative in the second hour, I think they did benefit. They were being cut off. There was people sort of bullying them a little bit, which I think actually did benefit them a little bit. Nothing they did, but I think that gave them a little bit of room. So that's the tone. But on the substance side, I got to tell you, this sort of, they had two main messages yesterday. One, we did it all for the kids. Number two, we weren't going to benefit at all. That's the messages I think they were trying to send. The second message, which is we weren't going to benefit at all, it defies description. It's incredible. And I don't mean incredible in the right way, in the positive way. It's like, listen, we've already heard that your bank loans aren't up to date. You've had to lay off hundreds of people out of your charity. You're obviously in some financial distress. The idea that, I'm not saying they're taking bags of money out of there, but the idea that you're not going to benefit from an immediate $30 million cash infusion so you can hire some of your people back and keep your operations running, it's so ludicrous as a message that I think I had a hard time getting past it at all.
Robin Sears of Ernst Cliff Strategies has done a lot of work with boards, both nonprofit and for-profit, and he joins me now. How do you think the Kielberger brothers did?
I thought they displayed two very unpleasant young men, disrespectful, insufficiently serious, and swaggering, all things one should never be before a parliamentary committee as a witness.
I was wondering, I would have assumed that they would have hired someone like you to prep them.
If they paid anybody for presentation training, they should get their money back.
Anything else that you want to see come out of this?
I'd like to see the Canadian charitable community examine itself with some care about these issues of governance, transparency, accountability, because it is not uncommon that situations like this exist in other charitable institutions. They just haven't stuck their foot in it badly yet, but everybody will who doesn't address these questions at some point, and better to start doing it now before you get caught like the Kielbergers have.
The deputy finance critic of the Conservative Party, Michael Cooper, MP, joins me now. What do you still have to know about we?
Well, there's a lot of interesting issues with we, including a number of questionable transactions that have taken place in terms of the acquirement of multiple properties in Toronto. There are questions about transparency and how they run for organization. But really, our focus is on the Prime Minister, on the finance minister, on issues around conflict of interest, and on how it came to be that this agreement was handed to we. It raises ethical questions, and at the very least, it raises questions about good governance and the competence of this government.
The consensus seems to be that the finance minister will not resign as a result of this. Do you see that?
He should. If this was a normal government, he would. But it isn't a normal government. We have a prime minister who thinks there's one set of rules for he and his friends and another set of rules for everyone else. And in terms of the conduct of the finance minister, if he were to resign, then I think a lot of people would be pointing next to the prime minister because from everything that we know, the prime minister's conduct is equally blameworthy to that of the finance minister, if not more so.
That was Fight Back's We Charity panel this past Wednesday. Michael Cooper, Conservative Deputy Finance Critic, strategist Robin Sears, strategist Kim Wright, strategist and President with Enterprise Jason Leader, and Conservative Finance Critic Pierre Poliev. This is Zoomer Radio's Best of Fight Back. I'm Jane Brown. On Wednesday, the governing PCs at Queen's Park released details of the independent commission they've named to look into the devastating impact of COVID-19 on our long-term care sector. 80% of the virus-related deaths were among our most vulnerable in nursing homes, giving Canada the worst record in the Western world. The inquiry will be led by Associate Chief Justice Frank Morocco, who has had a distinguished career, including as lead counsel for the province of Ontario in the Walkerton inquiry and as lead prosecutor in the Briac securities prosecution. But what will the commissioners tell us that we don't already know? And more to the point, can we wait until they report next April when a possible second wave is just around the corner? On Thursday, Libby Znaimer was joined by our long-term care panel of experts, Donna Duncan, CEO of the Ontario Long-Term Care Association, Jane Midas, staff lawyer and the institutional advocate at the Advocacy Center for the Elderly, and Marissa Lennox, chief policy officer at CARP, A New Vision of Aging.
One thing I was encouraged to see in the mandate was that commissioners are encouraged to consider areas that should be subject to further action by the government in order to help to prevent the spread of the disease in long-term care. And so from CARP's perspective, I think what we would hope is that the commissioner would also look at the role of home care, the role that home care could play in supporting seniors in a pandemic. We know many families took their loved ones from homes during the pandemic. They struggled to do so because of a lack of support, but they felt that they had to. These two sectors are so inextricably linked. We know that when provinces like Quebec, for example, increased pay for long-term care workers and not home care workers, it resulted in the number of people leaving the home care space. So I just think you can't talk about one without the other. And so with respect to the commission and the recommendations it puts forward, I would hope that home care would certainly be part of that.
Let's move along to Jane, your take.
It's unfortunate that this isn't a full public inquiry. I understand that the government wants this to be done quickly, and that is probably why it's not a full public inquiry. So, the problem with that is that you don't get parties being able to test the evidence, to ask questions of people. A lot of this is going to be done probably behind closed doors. So if you look back at the SARS Commission, they had about 600 people who came forward and spoke, but only, a small number of groups actually did that in public. And so that is concerning with respect to the kind of information and what the public will and will not know. And the same with the issues around some of the confidentiality is whether or not, we'll ever see any of those documents and exactly what happened during the early days. Obviously, the government has to move forward. We already know some of the things that have to be changed, such as four bedrooms. But I think that the initial response to the COVID in March is important to understand. And, we know that, a lot of the effort was put into hospitals. In fact, people were, pushed into long-term care who maybe shouldn't have gone there.
So I think that, you know, what we really need to do is to learn from the whole process. We already have learned something, but I think that we really need to know exactly what happened everywhere, what the ministry did, what public health did, and, you know, how to prevent this from happening again in the future.
Donna, what are your hopes from this?
Certainly, we've been very supportive of a process to help us understand what worked and didn't work in the first wave. And it really is important from our perspective to understand those other pieces of the system. So public health, the guidance that we were getting on masking and testing, we know that this virus was evolving and continues to evolve. But what impact did all those other pieces have on this? And I think to Marissa's point, where were some of those other pieces in the system? So if we think about a systemic approach to how we support our seniors, hopefully coming from this, there will be the voices of families and residents and staff and others who will be able to share their experiences and people from other parts of the system who can speak to what a seniors care need to look like on a go-forward basis. Certainly, we know what some of the root causes are, and our concern, quite honestly, has always been that we're going to get mired in a process without that we'll have to wait for action to happen. And the premier was very clear yesterday that we're going to do whatever it takes to make sure that we shore up our homes for a second wave. And we know what needs to be done around prioritizing our seniors, making sure those pieces fit together with testing and screening and surveillance, but also those partnerships, including with home care. We can't wait, but we also have to make sure that the government does whatever it takes, and we make sure that they make the investments to make sure that we have staff, that we have supplies, and that these homes are safe.
Donna Duncan, CEO of the Ontario Long-Term Care Association. Jane Midas, staff lawyer and the institutional advocate at the Advocacy Center for the Elderly. And Marissa Lennox, chief policy officer at CARP, A New Vision of Aging. I'm Jane Brown, and this is Zoomer Radio's Best of Fight Back. This past Friday, Toronto and Peel Region joined most of the rest of Ontario in entering stage 3 of the COVID-19 economic reopening plan. And while we are allowed to enjoy more amenities, how do we best go about conducting ourselves during this change? Libby asked this of Dr. Colin Furness, an infection control epidemiologist and assistant professor at the University of Toronto's Faculty of Information, along with Dr. Susie Hota, medical director of infection protection and control at the University Health Network.
I think vigilance needs to remain through all the stages of reopening. So, you know, just because we are going forward to a different stage doesn't mean that we can go beyond that, first of all. Reopening doesn't mean that we're able to go back to what we used to remember as normal. And, you know, things like physical distancing are more important than ever to maintain when it's appropriate to do so or necessary to do so, as well as masking and other infection prevention and control type measures.
Dr. Furness?
I agree. I think any opportunity that we can have to limit the amount of physical contact we have, bars may be opening, that doesn't mean we need to go. So I think really trying to imagine a new normal in at least the short to medium term where we're limiting physical contact despite the opening, I think would be safer and, well, you know, vigilance is the byword.
What do you make of the loosened restrictions on the numbers of big gatherings, albeit with physical distancing? It's gone way up from 10.
Yeah, I mean, I think from my perspective, if people are able to maintain the distancing that's required, then it could be okay. But, you know, it is opening up a bit of a can of worms. And the larger the gathering becomes, the harder it is to kind of monitor what people are doing and control what's happening around you. So it is a bit of a slippery slope. And I do think, you know, over time, I worry about people losing their vigilance and keeping up the physical distancing. So I think that's something we'll have to continue to reevaluate over time and make sure it's being done safely.
Dr. Furness, is that a mistake?
I'm more concerned, I think, that there could be, you know, some confusion in the messaging. So, you know, if I know people's names, then it's 10 people. But if I don't, it's 50, you know, in terms of what a gathering means. And I think it can really lead, as Dr. Hoda said, to a slippery slope. And I also worry that, you know, we know that it's large gatherings that really cause bad outbreaks, that really cause big problems. And I would avoid those until next year if we could.
There's masks and some people using shields, and I have heard from some people that the shield really isn't as good as the mask. Who has a view on that?
I guess my view is I don't feel like we have enough data yet to really give us the kind of confidence that we would need to say it's either equivalent or it's not as good or even maybe better than wearing masks. Like, it takes years and quite extensive research to truly understand how protective some of these measures are. I mean, there's some potential advantages on top of masks that face shields have, and that they provide some eye coverage, which would protect you from, you know, if you get exposure to your eye. But one of the disadvantages is that, you know, some of your the bottom might be open, and if it shifts around, you may be still susceptible to some spray or exposure.
Dr. Furness?
I agree, and I would think furthermore that because I see face masks being worn, face shields being worn rather high, remembering that a main benefit of masks is keeping your droplets to yourself, face shields I don't think would necessarily do nearly as good a job. But I agree, we don't have the data. Until we have the data, I'm gonna say masks, not face shields, seem to me intuitively to be better.
Colin Furness, what would you like to leave us with as we head into stage three?
I think the most important thing we can do is avoid crowds and avoid situations where people are indoors without wearing masks together. That's what COVID really likes. And I think we can have a lot of quote-unquote normal life if we just really attend to that. That's what will keep people safe.
And Dr. Hoda?
Yeah, I concur with that. I think, you know, these are all our choices to make. So we will do as well as we choose to do or as poorly as we choose to do. So, you know, it's the choice is in our hands, and I hope that we play it wisely.
Dr. Susie Hota, Medical Director of Infection Prevention and Control at the University Health Network, and Dr. Colin Furness, Infection Control Epidemiologist and Assistant Professor at the University of Toronto's Faculty of Information. I'm Jane Brown, and you're listening to the best of Fight Back. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer brings you comprehensive coverage of the news stories that interest you and your reaction to them on the phones. Here are some of this week's best calls. Donna in Burlington phoned to talk about how best to improve staffing in Ontario's long-term care homes.
Sorry, I don't remember the Premier of Quebec's name, but he announced, it's got to be over a month and a half ago, that they had are hiring or sending PSWs to school, 3-month training, and we'll be paying them $42,000 a year with benefits, retirement, full-time, not changing homes. And they've been there now, I think, almost 2 months, so they'll be ready in another month. And, I mean, I thought that makes it a good career for someone to go into and get the training, get benefits so they can afford to live. And why aren't we doing it?
And now, Fight Back's Knockout Call of the Week.
In fact, there were a lot of great calls this week, but the winner of the Fight Back Knockout Call of the Week comes from Heather in Toronto, who told us about how her mother suffered a horrible experience in long-term care during the COVID-19 lockdown.
Just after Mother's Day, I called and I said, how is my mother doing? She said, well, she had a fall. Got a cut on her head and she was limping a bit, but we're going to keep an eye on her. She seems fine. And then we went to see her at the window and they had her in a wheelchair. Now, she had been walking before that with a walk. I said, why is she in the wheelchair? Well, you know, she said her hip is sore because she's 92 and they said she was tired and she likes to be in the wheelchair. I went, okay. And then a month later, she's still in the wheelchair. They said to me, well, we sent in for a portable x-ray machine just to recheck her hip, just in case, because we did not see the fall. And it came back, she's got a broken hip.
Oh,
she had been there seven weeks with a broken hip in the chair, and they had been changing her, putting her into pants, all the time with a broken hip. Now, they never told us they were getting a portable x-ray machine, and we only found out because they had to call us to say, we think she needs surgery. She had the surgery. She was in there, ended up for like 3 weeks, heavily drugged on hydromorphone, and she had lost 15 pounds. And by the time she got back to the home, and I actually saw her 2 days ago, she is basically not there anymore.
Heather, thanks again for calling, and we hope your mom's condition improves. That does it for this week's Best of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. If you'd like to qualify for the Fight Back Knockout Call of the Week, phone us noon to one weekdays. Or if you have a comment, email us at fightback@zoomer.ca. Follow us on Twitter at Fight Back Libby, and have your say anytime on our Fight Back voicemail, 416-367-9636. 416-367-9636. I'm Jane Brown. Join us again next weekend when we'll round up the best of Fight Back.
The Best of Fight Back is produced by Jane Brown, Justin Eacock, and Zeev Hadi, with technical production by Kelly Robotham. Executive producer, Moses Neimer. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.